The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and this is a special Christmas edition. And those taking part are Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. And so, straight on into round one, which tries to test their vocabulary, 2 marks if they can give me the meaning of the following words reasonably correctly. We begin with Dillis Powell. Meaning, Dillis, of the word hyperphysical.
Hyperphysical. Hyper always means something going beyond.
Yes.
And physical means physical, I think.
Yes.
Going beyond the physical.
In what sense?
Supernatural.
Yes, supernatural it is. Dennis Norton, what is a luge? L-U-G-E.
A luge? My learned friend has just whispered in my ear that it's a toboggan.
Yes, you're dead right. Where would you normally find it? Where would you normally find it?
Where I normally find it? Well, if it was winter, I would find it in on the snow. If it was summer, I would find it in the back of the garage.
I give up. 2 marks. Switzerland, boy, trying to get out of you. It's a short raised toboggan, not the fastest kind, which is a bobsleigh, which you run down the cresta with 4 or 2 chaps very frightened on it. But the luge is what you take about down the streets and so on. Nancy Spain, what is, or are, Saturnalia, or it can be a Saturnalia?
A happy Christmas.
Well, not quite.
Well, it would have to happen on a Saturday.
No.
And you'd all have to get roaring back. It's an orgy, really.
Yes.
A Roman orgy.
Where did it start? Oh, yes, sorry.
What do you mean?
Yes.
You'll get a bowl of mead, and I'll show you.
I was trying to pin you back to its origin. Of
oh, country. Rome.
Yes,
yes,
Rome it was. That's good enough. 2 marks there. The point I was trying to elicit, as a matter of fact, was that it was an ancient Roman festival, and it did take place roughly at the same time as Christmas. And we took it over, as it were, in Christianity, so that the merrymaking at Christmas nowadays derives from this old pagan Roman festival.
Come and see our Christmas sometime.
Funnily enough, at that pub some of us went to, I wasn't there myself, just before we came to the show, there was a brass plate screwed to a seat just before the bar, and it said, Dennis Norden, Saturnalia.
I'm sure that's quite true. And back to Frank Muir himself. What is a bibber?
We're on the same subject, aren't we?
Yes.
It's imbibation, imbibing.
Yes. Overindulgence in
that's the
alcohol, tippling.
I've heard of these chapters.
Well, before we start round two, what I now do is to give each of the 2 teams a quotation, and I want them to write it down, and then I want the 2 women members of the team to study their quotations, and at the end of the program, I shall ask them where they come from. Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden, yours is, a new broom sweeps clean, and Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, yours, he who laughs last laughs the longest. And then at the end of the program, I ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these words came to be said or written, and I don't want any of these answers now. Uh-huh. And so on to round 2. Well, Christmas is perhaps almost the only time in these days of TV when party games seem to be still played and enjoyed, and here are some party games that have been played and enjoyed, anyway, played, ever since early Victorian times, and even before. And I want to know what they are. 2 marks for a right description. Dennis Powell, Crambo.
Crambo, it's usually dumb, I think, isn't it?
It can be, that's one version.
It's one of those things where you have where you pretend to be somebody else.
Yes, you would pretend to be someone else, I think.
It's a kind of charade.
Yes, charade. I'm going to give you 1 mark. The game is that a player in one team gives a word and either his opponent or the whole team of opponents must give a rhyme to it. And that's the ordinary spoken version. The dumb crambo, one side has to guess a word of which a rhyme is given by representing other rhymes in mime, which is very much harder. Dennis Norton, the game, Lou, L-double-O.
The game?
I do.
If you play it in a swimming bath, it's called Waterloo. Did you? It's a card game, isn't
yes?
it?
Yes.
Yes, it's a card game. Somebody goes out the room, and the other ones have to act in dumb charade what he's doing.
Half a mark so far. All right, we'll settle for half a mark, I think. Victorian card game. The penalties are put into a common pool, and the winner ultimately took the whole lot. All right, Nancy Spann. Snapdragon, and not the flower. Snapdragon.
Oh, it's dreadful. You have a whole heap of flame, burning brandy as a rule, and you have these raisins and almonds and things. And you have to rush in and get one. Actually, I'm very good at it because I have asbestos fingernails.
Yes. The point is that you're not allowed to wear gloves or protect yourself. That's
it's
it.
Known as a good hand for pastry, what I
have. Actually, that is a vivid description by Nancy of Snapdragon. Frank Muir, the game, Up Jenkins.
It should be played in the workhouse. Remember, the very famous workhouse character was called Jenkins. From the well-known ballad. And up spake one bold warrior, voice as bold as brass. Well, that was Jenkins. The way we used to play it, actually, when I was a ladling, was we all used to drink a bottle of whiskey, and the one who could get out was called Jenkins. It seemed to be much point. I mean, just as silly as plucking red hot raisins out of. I mean, there has to be a raison d'etre for all these things. I think, you know, I've been.
You haven't really described the game yet, Frank.
I've never heard of it.
All right.
One minute, hang on, Jack. One minute. Help coming. Yes, you secrete
yes.
something in your hand.
Yes.
Oh, yes, and you have to guess which hand is holding the coin.
Yes, you're absolutely dead right. You got there in the end. Great deal.
Do you mean that you have to guess which hand, or other people have to guess?
After the bottle of whiskey.
And the various lobster top.
Which of the five hands?
Yeah.
I only have the listeners have got a really sort of clear understanding now of the rules of Up Jenkins. Mm. Well, now, in the next round, this is much more serious. This is questions from literature, and I give each member of the team a quotation and ask them to complete it, the following line or the line after that, a couple if they like. Two marks if they complete the quotation, and two more if they get the source it comes from right. Dearest Powell, at Christmas, I no more desire a rose.
Shakespeare.
Yes, Shakespeare it is.
No more desire a rose.
All right.
Can we skip poetry and get back to prose?
Two marks for Shakespeare. But the quotation comes from Love's Labour's Lost. It's said by Byron, one of the characters in the play. At Christmas, I no more desire a rose than wish a snow in May's newfangled mirth, but like of each thing that in season grows. Then Dennis Norden, how blessed, how envied were our life, could we but scape the poulterer's knife.
Turkeys.
Yes, it's obviously about turkeys.
Yes?
I don't know. I've never heard it. I think Jack, it won't distress me if I don't hear it again.
I'm afraid you've got to, because I've got to complete it. But I'll give you one for turkeys. Mm. How blessed, how envied were our life, could we but escape the poacher's knife, but man cursed man on turkey's praise, and Christmas shortens all our days. John Gay, who wrote the Beggar's Opera also, fables the turkey and the ant. Nancy Spann, a little bit of cheating because this is more New Year than Christmas. Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light.
It's by Tennyson.
Yes.
The year is dying in the night, ring out wild bells and let him die.
Well done, absolutely right.
Johnny Mean.
Well done. Four marks, Tennyson in memoriam, four marks. Now, Frank Muir. And this is, on the third day of Christmas, my true love sent to me.
Sitting in the car for the children, trying to sing this.
Three French hens,
two turtle doves, and a partridge in the pan.
Absolutely right.
Author?
A partridge. No, it's trad.
Trad, traditional, anonymous, and as Frank quite rightly said, sotto voce. There are a great many more verses, but he gets his four marks. Well, in the next round, we have a series of things which, rightly or wrongly, are associated in our minds completely with Christmas. But I want to know where, in fact, they originated, how they came into being, what they originally connected with. Two marks if you get it more or less right. We begin with Dillis Powell again, and it is pantomime.
It was altogether miming.
Yes, and do you remember some of the original characters?
With pants on. Pants on mime.
Yes, you're getting
it. It had sausages, didn't it?
Yeah,
Harlequin, yes.
Columbine.
Yes.
Somebody with sausages.
Auguste, was it?
I think that's good enough. I think you'll get your two marks. As Dillis rightly says, it was originally meant everything actually performed in mime, without me speaking, and began in Rome, one man on a stage, simply miming with no words at all. Then came in Harlequin and Columbine as a love story, and a bit later, Clown and Pantaloon, and they were the first people who actually talked. Dennis Norden, Mistletoe.
Now, wait a minute, Mistletoe is something to do with druids.
Yes.
I don't know what it's to do with druids. I think they used to have these things at dawn at Stonehenge, where they used to lay them on a slab and kiss hit them with wet mistletoe. It's a dreadful way to die. Then it became adopted for Christmas.
That's it.
Yeah.
With a silver sickle.
Yes.
I think that's nearly good enough. Yes, I think two marks.
I hope it is. It didn't make sense to me, but it
Well, it's originally mistletan, which is a twig of basil. That's an Anglo-Saxon word. And it's supposed that the druids, if they ever existed, used it in their festivals. And because they were pagans and did use it, that's why even to this day you don't find mistletoe in decorations in churches at Christmas. The other odd thing, which I never knew before, but I've been told now, is that when you kiss under the mistletoe, it should mean that each man who steals a kiss should also take a berry, and when all the berries have gone off that bit of twig, then the kissing ought to stop, but it doesn't always.
Mm. We start on the holly, then. Hence the expression, a holiday.
Well, Nancy Spain, quickly. Yours is turkey.
Well, it was brought back by Sir Walter Raleigh. But what it has to do with Christmas, they carved it up for Thanksgiving, the Pilgrim Fathers.
They always eat it on Thanksgiving.
On November the 27th in America, and 23rd in Canada, which is very strange.
Yes, the association with Christmas is, as it were, quite accidental.
Negligible.
And turkey, it doesn't come from Turkey. The French call it dandan, which means a bird from India, and it doesn't
stuffing
come from India.
Or fallout.
And it really comes from North America. And now, Frank Muir, yours is a simpler one, the Christmas tree.
Wasn't this one of the Teutonic pleasantries introduced into the country by Prince Albert?
Yes, quite right, Prince Consort, Queen Victoria. We didn't have Christmas trees here at all.
Santa Claus, too.
Santa Claus, the German for St. Nicholas, he introduced that too. And Christmas trees came in with him. Though there was a sort of biblical reference given to it in Isaiah. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box together to beautify the place of my sanctuary. But the best sort of version of this is that the Prince Consort did it, and that's why we have it. Well, now we come to the last round, and I go back to the quotations that I gave to the two teams earlier in the program. And first of all, Nancy Spain, for two marks, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, "A new broom sweeps clean"?
Well, I honestly can't, but I will try. I mean, I don't know, but I will have a guess.
Well, do.
I think it might be said by a politician.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I think it might have been reported by a reporter of the time.
Well, there were actual chaps who did, in fact, put it. Whether they were the first people to do it, I just wouldn't
know. I'm sure it was said by some politician.
Well, it was lots of times, but...
Since, you mean?
Yes.
The first time?
First time.
Oh. I really don't know.
Well, if John Hayward Proverbs in the 16th century and John Lilly and Euphues a bit later, well, yes, still in the 16th century, the green new broom sweeps clean, or well, I wot, a new broom sweepeth clean. So it comes back.
Well, I wot, I like
it. That one got it really into character, didn't it? Well, I wot.
I don't think I'd give you any marks for that. I'm sorry.
No, I agree.
Now, Dennis Powell, the origin of yours, he who laughs last laughs the longest.
Well, I was going to say that it's trad, but I begin to wonder if it isn't Aesop or something like that. It ought to be Aesop.
I think your trad is probably good enough.
Make him look up Aesop.
I think it's an Aesop.
No, I can give you people who did quote it, but I think it was a common proverb in all languages before it turns up in literature at all. It's quoted by John Bamborough in a play, and it's quoted by Walter Scott in Favour of the Peak, though he rather learnedly puts it back into the French, il rit bien qui rit le dernier. So that I think it's a common proverb, and it's not wrong to say that.
Usually, he who laughs last then just seen the joke.
Is that true? Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, I want you as the audience to help, because the marks will go to whichever of the two unlikely explanations draws your greater mirth or applause. So back we go to Dennis Norden and ask him what really happened with this phrase, a new broom sweeps clean.
Well, it's terribly difficult buying Christmas presents for children. I have a daughter. I'm going back 2 years now. I have a daughter called Margaret. When she was 8, she wanted a poodle for her Christmas present. And in those days, you know, lots of people have poodles now, but in those days, poodles were rather sort of nouvelle vague, you know, they were very difficult to get hold of, terribly expensive. And suddenly I remembered that I knew a bloke called Frank Muir who breeds poodles. Well, when I say, you know, he breeds poodles, obviously he has a poodle which breeds. As a matter of fact, he has two poodles, which, you know, if they're going to be pedantic about this. And I went to him because I see him now and again, you know, and I said, can we strike a price on a poodle, you see? Which we did after some haggling. And I took this poodle home, Margaret, and on Christmas morning, I presented it to her. And she straight away burst out into tears of mingled grief and rage. So I said, what's the matter? So she said, I wanted a black one. And my son, whose name is Nicholas, although that, you know, it's nothing to do with the story, but he needs the publicity, you see, and he pointed out that the poodle I'd bought was a white one. So I said to Margaret, well, won't a white poodle do? And she said, no, I want a black one. So I said, well, it'll turn black. So she said, why? I said, well, poodles do. That one will turn black. She said, when? I said, oh, not long, you know, Easter or Ascot week, you know. Because I don't, you know, I kept it vague because I don't believe in lying to children, you see. And she went off fairly content with this. And about half an hour later, in came Bridget O'Flannery. Now, perhaps I should explain that. Bridget O'Flannery was at the time an Irish girl, as you may have gathered, who we had as what is called a mother's help. And she said, the little girl has just put the poodle up the chimney. Now, this is rather an unnerving thing to have said to you on Christmas morning, particularly in this rather phony accent, you see. So I rushed downstairs, and there was Margaret standing by the chimney, you see. And I said, what have you done? She said, I put the poodle up the chimney. So I said, why? And she said, because I didn't want to wait till Easter. I want a black one, you see. I didn't know what to do, and my wife came in. Her name... he'll come back to me. And she said, you'd better send for the sweep if you want to get it down. And he turned up about 20 minutes later. And what was terribly obvious was he was very young, and all his equipment was brand new, you see. And in fact, I commented on this, and he confessed that this was the first professional job he'd ever done as a sweep. Which is obvious. He's a young, very young bloke who had studied it at Oxford, actually. Yes, he'd taken what they call modern greats at... and he said, what is it you want doing? You see, and I said, well, we have a poodle up the chimney. He took that awfully well. And I said, and we want it brought down. He said, but I can't get it down because I haven't got the equipment. He said, but I can push it further up. So I said, well, what good will that do? He said, well, it'll come out the top of the chimney. And I said, well, that's clever because it'll just fall off the roof. He said, no, you have somebody standing by to receive it when it comes up the top. So I said, but we've got three chimneys. He said, well, look, if you don't trust me, I tell you what we'll do. We'll block the other two chimneys up, you see. So I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, get somebody to go up there and sit on them. Well, immediately, Nicholas was up there and sitting on a chimney clear with one. And then the other chimney, well, I said to this great Irish colleen that we had, well, you're very much the right shape for sitting on a chimney. And we sent her up the other one, and I waited downstairs with the sweep, and he screwed all his brushes together, and he was shoving them up the chimney and pushing away. And after about 10 minutes of this, I looked round, and there was Margaret standing by me with a smile on her face and a white poodle dog in her arms. And I said, what are you doing with that? She said, April Fool. And I said to my wife, you really must teach this child the months of the year. And at that moment, the sweep said, hello, I'm onto something, I've got resistance, I can feel resistance. He gave a great shout. There was a scream from aloft. And through the window, I saw Bridget travelling downwards at a great speed. Well, luckily she wasn't hurt because my wife had just gone out at that moment, so her fall was broken. That is about all that there is to the story, except the headline that the local paper gave when they printed all about it, and they said, a new sweep brooms Colleen.
Didn't see how he was going to get out of that at the end, but he did. And so we go back to Frank Miller, and his quotation, if you remember, was, he who laughs last, laughs the longest.
Well, my explanation of this is very brief. It was said by Frédéric Chopin in March 1851. Well, it was after he had this lobster, you see. Well, you know, he was staying with the Abbey Liszt at the time, the composer. No, well, you see, Frédéric Chopin had been to London to play for Queen Victoria. And he'd had a cup of tea and an Osborne biscuit afterwards. and the Queen hadn't liked it awfully. Chopin had tried to play one of his preludes, and she'd... It was only allowed to play just the prel, because nothing lewd was allowed. It was all extremely awkward because he had this friend of his, you see, this girlfriend called George Sand. So in something of a dudgeon, he left England and went to Hungary on a European tour. And there he played his latest composition, Nocturne in the Old Kent Road. Now this, I'm afraid, got a raspberry in Hungary. So Chopin called on the only real friend he had in Hungary, which was the old Abbé Liszt. And his compositions, of course, one knows, his wonderful Liebestraum, you know, which is a light, dry hock. And of course, Chopin stayed with Liszt because Liszt himself was only too glad of the company, because he sat all day in his etude or study and composed these piano pieces, and he composed this magnificent thing which went da 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 da, and he didn't know what to call it. And the only way that Liszt could think was to stay awake all night, and the only way he could stay awake all night was to eat lobster for dinner, you see. These were the continental lobsters, which were called langouste. And then Chopin wrote another piece,
which he called the Minute Waltz. And he played it on Christmas Eve at the Conservatoire, and afterwards he went over to the left-wing place, the Laboratoire. When he got back home, it was rather late Christmas Eve, it was really Christmas morning, and Abbey List waited up, and he said, "How did it go?" And he said, "Not at all well. In fact, I got my second Hungarian raspberry." This said, "That is my title. That is what my piece will call, da 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 da, the second Hungarian Rhapsody." He's so terribly grateful to Chopin, he said, "We'll have an extra large Christmas dinner." And they brought it in, and there it was, these langoustes again, these dreadful great lobsters. And George Sand was very fed up and said, "Really, you should say something and clear out of this place." And what was my line?
"Oh, he who laughs the longest."
Oh, and yes, that's right, yes, of course. And he said, "Why don't we just go somewhere else and have a decent Christmas dinner?" And old Chopin placed his hand on George Sand's arm and said, "No, he who loves Liszt loves the longest."
A new edition of Grove's Musical Dictionary coming out very shortly after that, and I think by your verdict, Frank Muir just gets the mark, though a very close show with Dennis. And that brings us to a final score at the end of the round, in which Dennis Power and Frank Muir win by 2.5 marks from Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden, and it also brings to an end this edition, this Christmas edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Thank you.